Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week, Adam and I get into the consumer spirit with a countdown of the top five box office bombs that we will admit to liking.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Fever Marlene, and a discussion of the first film in our 70s sci-fi marathon, The Omega Man.
But first, the summer blockbuster season begins with Robert Downey Jr. in Iron Man. Insert obligatory Black Sabbath reference here.
Your eyes are red. Your tears for your long-lost boss?
Tears of joy. I hate job hunting.
Yeah, vacation's over.
Welcome home, sir.
Put up the scanner, will you? What happened over there?
I have my eyes open.
I want to protect the people I put in harm's way.
A man with a dozen of these can rule all of Asia.
Yeah, I can fly.
When given the reins to Iron Man by Marvel Comics' newly formed production company, Jon Favreau, a fan of the comic himself, took a sort of different approach to the film. He solicited input from fans of the long-running comic through a MySpace page. He took snippets of the film to Comic-Con. And it's apparent throughout the film he's buried little nuggets for die-hard Iron Man fans. Adam, I'm going to keep it simple. We've been waiting through months of studio flotsam and jetsam here, looking for our own nuggets to review. Now summer begins and we get the first blockbuster of the year. I'm really not that interested in Stan Lee cameos or nods to other supervillains. I want action. I want Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow and Jeff Bridges chewing the scenery. Is there enough here in Favreau's Iron Man for the casual moviegoer? Or is this film strictly for the aficionados?
Well, my guess is that the casual moviegoer probably will enjoy this movie, and I certainly hope they will. I'm not that familiar with the comic book, so I can't really speak to how much the movie tries to really tap into that and please that audience, though I think I even obviously pick up on the Stan Lee references or the Stan Lee cameo we get in the film. I get that. Jon Favreau also with a little role in the film himself as Robert Downey Jr.'s bodyguard. But the things you talked about that you wanted to see, you get here. You get Jeff Bridges chewing the scenery. You get action, I think. You get Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow, who are really good together. And I'm sure that no other critic has made this comment. I'm really going out on a limb here. But Robert Downey Jr., I think, really makes this movie. He and Paltrow together, she plays his assistant, Pepper Potts. They pull off, for me, a Nick and Nora Charles kind of dynamic. There's this great charm they have, and he always certainly has a drink in his hands, at least early in the film, that reminded me of The Thin Man. And I just think the patter of their dialogue and the humor is really good and really fun to watch. There seems like Downey even had a few good bits that he probably improvised, and Favreau gave him enough leash to do what he wanted with. I just think that Downey Jr.'s charisma, his facility with language, and his humor make a character who could be pretty vapid and unlikable a much more interesting character. And I like that kind of screwball comedy element to this action movie, which is something we really haven't seen before.
All that stuff really fell flat for me.
Really?
Especially the Paltrow and Robert Downey Jr. stuff.
I loved it.
Oh, I didn't feel it at all.
Huh.
If you gave them some of the Thin Man dialogue, I would buy it. But I just didn't buy that for a second. And my main problem with this film, look, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. You can slap this thing on the side of a Burger King glass. It's going to sell. But that's about it. And my main problem is Jon Favreau, is the direction here. I think that he takes what could have been, come on, you said it yourself, Tony Stark, my God, he's sort of the anti-hero,
he is,
if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chance for some great character exploration there, and he really, really disappointed me. I mean, I think this film is sort of filmed entirely paint by numbers, sort of in a Saturday morning cartoon fashion. Cinematography, photography-wise, I didn't feel there was one memorable aspect to it. It just seems like every single scene, he was asking the audience to go, oh man, isn't that so cool? Isn't that so cool? And unfortunately, that does not a movie make.
Well, it did for me in this case. I think that often will make a good summer movie, and it did for me. I actually think that Favreau, you're right, he doesn't do anything really interesting with the camera here at all. There isn't a memorable shot or really a memorable scene, but I actually
but
give him credit.
There's no plot either. There's no storyline.
The problem is the plot, as we get to the end, and you'll hear my big complaint with the film here in a minute, but where I give Favreau some credit is that he doesn't try to cover things up with a lot of flash either. He's pretty dull, but I think by design. The scenes of Tony Stark working, for example, in the lab and the type of technology at his disposal, I think that's really fun. And he lets those scenes play out in a way that's totally believable.
Now, but think about that. That could have been so great. And you're right.
I thought they were.
I love the time we spend in the lab because you have a guy creating himself, basically rebuilding himself. I think that's fascinating. I think that's gritty. Unfortunately, what Favreau seems to go for in those moments, too many jokes. Way too many jokes, and it's really, really light. And, you know, it's sort of him playing around with this stuff, trying to fly without really any explanation of what it is, of the blood and sweat going into this. I think there could have been much more exploration of the darker side of this guy and the change of this guy.
Maybe so. I think you could have had that, and maybe it would have made a more interesting film. I don't know. What I like, though, about those scenes is I was sitting there saying, wow, isn't that so cool? And if that's all he was going for, it worked for me. Because what I liked about the camera, as I said, is that he keeps it pretty still, and he allows us to see this play out without a lot of effects or editing, to the point where when you see him elevating himself off the ground where he's testing his thrusters or whatever, you really believe that. This isn't Michael Bay, his school of shooting and editing here. And even when he's first creating the suit, it doesn't gloss over the production of that, but it shows him at work. And I just think that origin stories are always the most interesting here with superheroes, and he gives all of that a lot of attention. I think that how you become a superhero is more interesting than what you do as a superhero. I think Favreau gets that. Unfortunately, when he does become the superhero, that is where this movie goes downhill.
Who is he fighting? Who is he really fighting? Right. These nameless Arabs in Afghanistan. I don't think they're the Taliban, and they fire at him with his own weapons. We already know how this thing is going to play out.
We do.
I mean, I'm not a comic book guy. There has to be a wealth of plot lines that he could have pulled from comic books to really build this thing. But unfortunately, Jeff Bridges, we're not ruining anything by saying Jeff Bridges is the bad guy.
It's obvious the moment you see him.
The moment you see him isn't given anything to do here.
No,
really,
he really isn't.
And I really feel bad. What does he want? What does he really want?
Villain wants?
Did he want
power?
Really? Is
money?
That what it is?
I don't know.
Is that what it is? He wants the arc reactor technology? He wants more money? He wants Tony Stark out of the way? I didn't get it. And another thing that really sort of annoyed me about it is Jeff Bridges has started this lip smacking thing. Have you noticed that?
Mm-hmm.
It started in The Contender where he just kind of, you know, he just kind of, it bugged the bejesus out of me.
Well, one thing I will also give Favreau a little bit of credit for is that he does make a superhero movie a little bit political and a little bit relevant getting heavy-headed.
He
at least puts it in a modern context that we understand and makes sense. And when we certainly see the change that Downey's character goes through.
Oh, we understand. Oh, look, those Arabs have RPGs. They must be bad. We don't need a backstory on what they're actually fighting for.
Well, are you really expecting that from a summer movie? I'm not anyway, but I think that what Favreau does a little bit is he does successfully trick us just slightly when it comes to the villains of this film. There's no doubt we know who the real bad guy is behind all of this, like I said, from the moment, unfortunately, Jeff Bridges walks on screen. And I actually think that's to the movie's detriment. I think it's Jeff Bridges' fault as a performer and Jon Favreau's fault. And I think it could have been better had they not been so obvious. But you actually assume, or at least I assume, that Farhan Tahir, this leader of this Afghani group, is going to prove to be Tony Stark's true nemesis. He's the leader of this group killing these innocent people. He's got the brooding, bald supervillain look down, certainly. And when it comes out, though, if you want to say he's trying to make any kind of political statement here, he isn't even evil enough, though, to match good old corporate greed. When it really comes down to it, that's who is evil here. That's the evil force that Tony Stark has to fight against. Unfortunately, the way it all then plays out in the end, Favreau spends so much time developing that origin story to have it flame out the way it does with the good guy and the bad guy fighting each other one-on-one. It felt so unoriginal to me in a movie that I otherwise thought was a pretty fresh spin on the genre. And more than the lack of originality even, Maddie, it's just that there was no payoff to it. The relationship between Jeff Bridges' character and Tony Stark's character wasn't developed enough
established from the beginning.
It wasn't enough to make what they were doing, what they were fighting, compelling at all. The movie unfortunately does just devolve into summer spectacle and doesn't have the stakes that the movie initially set up.
One of my problems with this film, I love Robert Downey Jr. here. He's having a lot of fun. We're having a lot of fun with him. It's fun to watch him play this sort of playboy, this Lothario, and, you know, with absolutely no responsibilities. Unfortunately, we're watching him do that, and we're just sort of giggling away the entire time, going, oh, man, I can't believe that. Oh, that guy's so cool. He's got chicks dancing on his own airplane. Look, that should actually be kind of scary. There's just another element that could have been dug up here. And Favreau's on record as saying, I looked online at some interviews today, that the grittier stuff, he's planting the seeds for that. I guess Iron Man really sort of deals with alcoholism sort of further down the road. So he's sort of planting the seeds for sequel. I'm hoping the stories just get better because, yeah, it's really flashy, it's really fun, but there's just no meat there.
Okay, well, it didn't blow me away, but I definitely recommend it. I thought a lot of the action scenes early on were pretty cool and obviously love Robert Downey Jr. Unfortunately, Terrence Howard, completely wasted here his role. And that
whole plot
line. What was Clark Gregg
doing in the film?
Yeah, I don't know. But Terrence Howard's whole role, we could just talk about that. I don't even understand how he's like a company shill for Tony Stark, but then he's also like in command centers overseeing missions. It just doesn't make any sense at all, and I thought he was wasted. But Iron Man is out now in theaters this week, and obviously we're a little bit split, I guess, on whether or not you should rush out to see it. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Where's the enthusiasm for Pixar's WALL-E this summer? Not even an honorable mention? I can excuse Maddie, but Adam, you have kids for crying out loud. Your feedback is up next. Stay with us.
Oberlin. Oberlin. You've got so much. So much behind your eyes, I'll be by your side. I'll be by your side. I'll be by your side.
You know a Clarence WALL-E?
Yes.
You know where we can find him?
Yes, I do. Oh.
Oh, where?
At the Beverly Ambassador.
Where's that?
Well, you go. No. Yeah, go down. Go down beach. You guys want to smoke a bowl or...
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and a clip there from the classic film True Romance, a tie-in last week with our top five most anticipated movies of the summer. There's a connection to Pineapple Express there. And Maddie, Matt Gilbert in Brooklyn, New York wants to know, who the hell is Gary? You mean Floyd the Stoner?
Well, look, okay, I'm sorry. You know me. I don't do any research on my own. Someone gives me my top five.
I just read it. Okay.
I thought his name was Gary. And it's still here on the piece of paper. I'm going with Gary.
And I didn't correct you because the fact is I've only seen True Romance once.
Right.
I really liked it.
Doesn't he sound like a Gary?
He does kind of sound like a Gary. I see where you were coming from, but we were wrong last week, and we wanted to make that correction here on the show. We're going to get into some great listener feedback here in a moment. More thoughts on our summer movie preview. But first, we do want to share our poll results and get into our new poll question for this week. And it does relate to summer. We asked you last week on the show what your least anticipated summer movie was, and we gave you these five choices. The Love Guru, the Mike Myers film, Mamma Mia, Sex in the City, Wanted, or What Happens in Vegas. Maddie, how did it come out?
Well, number one, 29%. These are basically all the 13 to 28-year-old males voting, I think. Sex in the City. But close behind at 28%, What Happens in Vegas. So I think there you've got the disaffected females chiming in as
Maybe
well.
So.
Number three, The Love Guru, 24%. Mamma Mia, 16%. And Wanted, 4%. I think we're probably going to get into some emails, or we got a lot of responses anyway, because Wanted was directed by the same director that brought us Day Watch and Night Watch,
yes.
A favorite films of Film Spotting.
Well, we did enjoy Night Watch when we reviewed it here on the show. I haven't yet had the chance to see Day Watch, but I was aware of that. The fact is, we've both seen that trailer. We think it looks brutal, that Angelina Jolie
terrible.
Film. Even with my boy James McAvoy in the cast as well. Maddie's rolling his eyes. So we're not excited about Wanted, but Sex in the City was the one most of our listeners are really not looking forward to, along with What Happens in Vegas, which was our choice last week. This week's poll question, we want to know what your most anticipated summer movie is, excluding The Dark Knight.
All right. Your choices are Indiana Jones 4, something about skulls and crystals,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Iron Man opening this week, Pineapple Express, Tropic Thunder, WALL-E, the new Pixar film, or Other.
Yes, and you heard our choices last week on the show. I guess right now of those, we're most excited about Tropic Thunder.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. I mean, I have to admit it. Of course, the nostalgia pick, I'm going with Indiana Jones as well. But what I'm worried is that Spielberg's just going to turn this into joke after joke of how old he is.
A lot of winking at the
audience. Yeah, exactly. Don't do that. Give me Indy. Give me Indy fighting the communists or whatever it is. Don't wink at me.
Okay. Well, hopefully there will be no winking. We want to know what you think, what summer movie you're most looking forward to. Go to filmspotting.net. And make your voice heard. And now, Maddie, it is time for another fun-filled installment of Maddie's Movie Minute.
Maddie's Movie Minute. He takes us to the show for 60 seconds or so and gets right to the point of what we need to know.
And now,
here's Maddie.
So Maddie's Movie Minute this week, I wrangled a date, a non-actress, which makes my mom happy.
Shocking.
Yeah, a non-Norwegian, makes my grandmother happy. And we go out on the town, have a great night in Chicago. We're strolling through Millennium Park. We grab some dinner. The conversation, pretty good, I have to say. Couple dry spells. We cap it off. We're going to go see Baby Mama. You know, it's fun. I'm sort of secretly registering what she's laughing at. It's a good way to, you know, identify a date. I actually pull out my notepad and pencil and take notes. You know I never, ever do that. And I'm chuckling throughout the better part of it. I'm not really, really laughing. About halfway through, bam, movie burns up inside the projector. And I'm actually thinking, wow, this is all right. Now we don't have to, you know, spend all this time in this theater. We can actually go out, grab a couple beers, something like that. She says to me, well, you know, I really have to rest up. We're celebrating my grandma's birthday tomorrow.
Ouch.
Grandma's birthday.
Have you heard that one before?
Haven't heard from her since. So I have no idea how Baby Mama ends, and frankly, I don't care.
Maddie's Movie Minute. Maddie's Movie Minute. Quick reviews to help you choose it. Maddie's Movie Minute.
All right, Maddie. Well, I'm sorry that date did not go as you would have liked it, but let's go ahead and hear from someone out there, a listener who does approve of you, Corey in Toronto.
He says, Maddie, you couldn't be more right about Forgetting Sarah Marshall. What a fantastic comedy and easily the first great film of 2008 that I've seen. It's hysterically funny with more big laughs and much more consistently funny than either 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, or Superbad. The other Apatow films have all suffered from too much improv that really slowed down the pace and often led to losing sight of the plot. This film is very concerned with the plot and the character arcs. Sure, the lines and discussions are funny on their own, but they are made 10 times funnier by being set in a totally believable and interesting context. And hell, any movie that has a parody of CSI called Crime Scene, The Scene of the Crime, is clearly a work of genius. I could not agree more with Corey. He's exactly right. Work the jokes, work these great, you know, improvised characters into the script, always considering how is this moving the plot forward. I think that's where this film succeeds.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we did get a few emails, of course, from some listeners who were not blown away by Forgetting Sarah Marshall, but more listeners were like Corey and like this one here. Emma, Standring True Blood in Oak Park, California, my favorite film spotting name. You both reacted to Forgetting Sarah Marshall just like 6 teenage girls did. The first thing my friends and I all said after we left the theater was how much we love Russell Brand's character. He was absolutely brilliant and slightly attractive in a needs-a-shower sort of way. The Apatow machine is amazing. It makes movies that are focused on guys, made by guys, and seem to have guy humor, yet by the end of the movie, it's got teenage girls melting in their seats due to the sweetness. Also, I'll never be able to watch Jason Segel and How I Met Your Mother the same way I used to after that scene. Very well said by Emma. And something I mentioned to you when we got off air after our review of Forgetting Sarah Marshall a few weeks ago was that I think the key scene that really shows how smart this movie is and how sophisticated it is compared to other movies of its ilk is the scene where, without giving anything away, Kristen Bell, who's sort of supposed to be the villain here because she dumped our hero, Peter, she goes and talks with his new love interest, Mila Kunis, and it's all set up to be the scene where she basically tries to sabotage their relationship.
Yes.
And instead, she doesn't. She just talks to her, says Peter's a great guy, and gets kind of emotional. It's a really nice scene, and it goes against everything we're used to seeing.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's two women talking to each other about a common man, and people say that Apatow can't write for women. Well, the fact of the matter is that scene is really, really good and really, really hits home. I will admit, I would say the first 20 minutes of this film, it takes a while to get going, but once he's there, once he's in Hawaii, I think that's when this movie really takes off.
So you had a problem with all the male frontal nudity is what you're saying.
No, actually, not the first 3 minutes. I absolutely adore male frontal nudity. Sort of the Bill Hader early scenes didn't quite connect as well as they could have.
I would agree with that. Well, we did get another batch of great feedback on our top five vacation movies, which was a tie-in with Forgetting Sarah Marshall and also our trip to the Sarasota Film Festival.
Well, Will from North London writes in, and I've been ordered by the FCC not to do accents anymore. Top five vacation movies, or holiday films, as we'd call them over here.
Now, there you could have done the accent,
yeah,
Maddie.
I know. Thanks. No, that's fine. I won't do them anymore.
And I just want to say, it wasn't me. It wasn't me.
No, it's fine. Decisions were made. Anyway, you made a staggering omission from your list, With Nail and I. I hope you both have seen this 80s British classic. I'll own up right now saying I have not seen it. How about you, Mr. Kempner?
I have seen it.
It's a film full of quotable, memorable moments with a career-defining performance from Richard E. Grant as the permanently drunk With Nail. Made all the more special when you take into account that Grant was a teetotaler. I'm on my third film spotting podcast now and loving it. Keep up the good work, fellas. Well,
huzzah.
Mr. Kempinar, what is your excuse?
Well, welcome aboard, Will. We're glad to have you listening to the show. I love With Nail and I don't know why. I think I had it on my honorable mentions or kind of in that list of 6 through 10 that didn't quite make the cut. I am a big fan of that film. It is one of the all-time great drinking films, certainly one of the all-time great quotable films, and Richard E. Grant is amazing in it. Again, one of those films that's a stretch as a vacation movie, maybe, though they do sort of just go out into the country to drink and get out of the city a little bit. But then again, I have no leg to stand on when it comes to movies that don't really qualify as vacation movies.
Yeah, well, let's hear from Seth in Brooklyn, New York.
Yes, Seth Michelizzi says, kudos for picking Roger Dodger, Adam. I've been espousing the awesomeness that is Roger Dodger to anyone within earshot for a long time now. Showed it to a few friends, and all of them have loved it. Perhaps the opening scene could become a massacre theater sometime. One can dream. And Brad Naples in Edmond, Oklahoma, also wrote in and said, when I name Roger Dodger as my number two vacation movie, I completely flipped. While I agree with your own admission that calling this a vacation movie is quite the stretch, I equally agree that any opportunity to sing the praises of this film should not be wasted. Thank you, Brad and Seth.
Yeah, I really do like Roger Dodger. It's a good film. I think it's one that's been sort of trumpeted a lot here on Film Spot.
It has.
We
Maybe
get
not
a lot
in a while,
of emails.
Though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Stephen Wilson from Glasgow, Scotland writes in, great show as usual, but I must admit to being disturbed by your top five vacation movies this week. I'm not doing a Scottish accent. Maddie just about gets a pass for the holidays gone wrong theme throughout his top five, but Adam, how could you fail to include Before Sunrise, Before Sunset? Getting off a train with Julie Delpy and wandering around Vienna for an evening in Before Sunrise, doesn't that sound like the perfect holiday to you? Or having a second chance, one that got away in the City of Romance in Before Sunset? For shame, Mr. Kempinar. That said, I still love you guys.
Well, I wrote back to Stephen when this one came in and said, for shame indeed, because this would be my number one or number two. I don't think that Before Sunset really counts because, again, he goes over on a book tour and she's already living there. There isn't really a vacation aspect to it. But Before Sunset, I mean, come on. They're both really on vacation. They're on a trip, a film I absolutely adore. I've got no excuse. I overlooked it. Should have been on my list.
All right, well, moving on to summer movies. A bunch of people wrote in with some suggestions. There was quite a theme. Why don't you take this one from Dennis Casper in Medina, Ohio?
Yes. Where's the enthusiasm for Pixar's WALL-E this summer? And note that we did include it in the poll question about your most anticipated summer movies. Not even an honorable mention. I can excuse Maddie for not putting this on his list, but Adam, you have kids for crying out loud. This little robot is going to be the cutest thing on screen since E.T. I haven't found anyone with a heart who can resist the trailer with this little robot in it. I have four kids myself, and I think that I might be more excited to see this than them. I guess I shouldn't be too surprised that WALL-E was missing from the conversation, since there was a definite lack of enthusiasm for the beloved Ratatouille last year. Maybe I should seek out, wait for it, Michael Phillips' most anticipated summer movies instead. Ouch. Well played, Dennis.
Dude, look, I love Toy Story. I love Toy Story 2. But the fact of the matter is, I really think Pixar has been delivering diminishing returns since Finding Nemo. You know, they put out this, of course, this perfect trailer that's going to get kids and adults alike to not only go and see the movie, but to buy the lunchbox, to buy the DVD, to buy the action figures. And I think you're very smart. You are cutting yourself off from it completely. You're going to keep your kids away from this movie completely, and I commend you.
Well, it's a nice thought, Maddie, but that's not true. I will be taking Holden and Sophie and maybe even little Quinn to see WALL-E, but I do have to confess, until I sat down today and forced myself to seek out the trailer, I haven't yet seen a trailer for this movie, and I'm also not a person who just naturally gets really excited about animated films. Mm-hmm. That's why it's not on my list. I mean, I love Toy Story, both films. I love Finding Nemo. My kids adore Cars, and even though Ratatouille didn't do a whole lot for me, I do see the brilliance of Brad Bird. So I like all those films. I'm not trying to take anything away from the Pixar folks at all, but the fact is I haven't seen a preview for it, so I couldn't get excited. Oh. I did watch it today. It does look great. The animation looks incredible. I'm sure it's cute. I'm kind of with one of our listeners in the message boards, though, Maddie, who pointed out that it's basically Short Circuit, and I loved it when it was Johnny Five instead of WALL-E.
Oh, I do love Short Circuit.
Yeah.
It looks so self-congratulatory. Back in 1996, we had an idea about this little robot that could. Oh, come on. Yeah. Give me a break.
Well, you are going to have to read all of the negative emails we get because of that. Why don't we go ahead and read this one, Maddie, from Austin. He's got some more thoughts on WALL-E just to try to make up for the vitriol you are spewing.
All right. He's writing in from beautiful Carmel, Indiana. It's not that I'm not looking forward to any of the films you mentioned. Hamlet 2 and Pineapple Express in particular look hilarious. It's just that I can proudly say I'm looking forward to WALL-E the most of all the films this summer. I will always see a Pixar film eventually, but when I first heard that the first 40 minutes of this film have no dialogue, my interest peaked considerably.
Do you think is that really true? I'd never heard that.
That's amazing. I've never heard that. I've never heard that.
I believe it. I just am kind of shocked. I mean, that will be something to see.
I cannot believe any studio exec would sign off on that.
We'll see. They kind of can do whatever they want, Pixar can.
Then I saw the most recent trailer, and I'm already whispering the phrase, potential American masterpiece. It looks that good. I'm telling you, Disney is so good. You must resist, people.
You must resist. People are brainwashed here.
They are so good because they're so talented. They give you exactly what they want, and then you go and you get out your cash, and you're forking over for the bookmarks and everything else.
Well, let's close with this one from Jake Meltzer in Columbia, Missouri. His top five most anticipated summer movies with no restrictions here. Number five, Indiana Jones, because come on, it's Indiana freaking Jones. Number four, Iron Man. It looks like just the right balance of humor and action to be a damn good time. Number three, Pineapple Express, the newest Apatow movie, looks to potentially be the funniest one, and I don't even smoke pot. Number two, Tropic Thunder, the cast, the premise, plus Robert Downey Jr. as a black man equals brilliant movie. And number one, The Dark Knight. Christian Bale is my favorite actor, and the late Heath Ledger looks like he will give an iconic performance to remember him by. I love Batman Begins, and this will step it up a notch. We were both a little underwhelmed by Batman Begins, so I do hope it does take it up a notch. Should be something exciting to see with The Dark Knight. We appreciate all the feedback we got. Of course, if you have any thoughts for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and look for the next Film Spotting After Hours podcast available for download on Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. Of course, you can get it through the podcast or come to our website, filmspotting.net, and listen to the extra show.
Exactly. Well, time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater and Take Your Stinking Paws Off Me, You Damn Dirty Albino in Sunglasses. Our 70s sci-fi marathon kicks off with Charlton Heston in The Omega Man. Stay with us.
Lemon King Mahoney sat upon the shore, waved out to the ocean at 1164. Lemon King Mahoney, barely 23, lost along the way. He placed the waves beneath his feet. Don't best of me, I'm both knees, baby. You'll never be the one I don't know.
He won't hurt you, Gertie. He won't hurt you, Gertie. I'm not gonna hurt you. Is he a boy or a girl? He's a boy. Was he wearing any clothes?
No.
But look, you can't tell. Not even Mom.
Why not?
Because grown-ups can't see him.
Only little kids can see you.
Give me a break.
Well, do you know what's going to happen if you do tell?
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show wherein Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard with Henry Thomas and Drew Barrymore from E.T., a tie-in, of course, with our summer movie preview. E.T., of course, one of the highest-grossing summer movies of all time. Now, Adam, I was too young to actually see this in
of
the
course.
Theater, but I do remember we had to get on the wait list for it on video when it
really?
Finally came out.
Yeah, and of course I shared the cinematic memory here on the show a while back that it's the first movie that made me confront my manhood. I didn't want to cry at the end, and I just couldn't help it. I think maybe I was able to hold them back, but maybe I've repressed that memory. And I do think if I found the numbers correctly, it ranks 25th still on the list of all-time blockbusters in terms of its gross. Nick Lundgren wrote in and claimed that our scene was the scariest thing he's ever heard. And Jared from Dorchester wrote in noting, so many memorable things came from that movie. My first cinema crush, Drew Barrymore. E.T. cereal, it tasted just like Reese's Pieces. It was the first time the theater got dusty for me, obviously me too. And I cut my pinky off trying to make a Galaxy phone with my Speak and Spell and a saw blade.
Wow.
Okay, the last one is a lie, but the list goes on. Nicely done, Jared.
All right, Adam, reach into the Film Spotting hat, and why don't you pick out this week's winner?
And we did get a ton of entries this week, one of our most popular ever in the top 10. The winner is Liz Adams from Akron, Ohio.
The Rubber City, home of Goodyear.
Congratulations. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, Liz, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Oh, yeah. Makes perfect sense, Nick. I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Hey, what about you, Chad?
I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam, bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the block, it's really going to open things up for me.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, it ties in with a couple of topics being discussed on this show.
It's a tough one, though. I mean, this is kind of tough. There is a direct tie-in.
Yes.
Actually, two.
Yes.
But I think a lot of people are going to be surprised by this one.
I agree. I think we could stump some people, though. The people that really know this film and love it, as many do, they're going to get it right away.
Yeah,
I think.
Well, because do remember, we are doing our top five box office bombs that didn't stink. So remember that. But then again, we were looking at all these films to do, and the fact of the matter is no one has seen a lot of these box office
bombs. A lot of them
bombs.
Really are junk and have been ignored, maybe deservedly so. Let's go ahead and start off the scene. You start it. I'll give you the action. And action.
You'd be surprised how many people want to steal scrap. But man, once I turn it into art, I can't give it away. I mean, what am I? A junk man who sells art or an artist who sells junk? You tell me.
I like it. I think. Listen, you're not going to call my mom, are you? She doesn't know I'm out.
Don't worry, kids. Not my style. Report a guy to the authorities. I want to have some coffee. What do you want? Some milk or what? Milk?
Coffee's fine. I drink it. I'm hip.
I don't know. This is espresso, you know? It's like CoffeeZilla.
I said, I'm hip.
And scene. And you are so hip, Mr. Kempinar.
Aren't I? If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, May 7th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
All right, our discussion of The Omega Man is coming up here in a second. But first, Maddie, I did want to quickly mention my experience over the weekend at Ebert Fest. I did make it down to Champaign. Just for Saturday, saw three movies there, ran into Michael Phillips, our friend from the Chicago Tribune, who mentioned that he ran into a bunch of Film Spotting listeners who came up and talked to him. I didn't run into any Film Spotting listeners. Apparently, he's more recognizable than I am.
Did he talk to you about Wally?
No, he didn't. Sadly, he did not, but enjoyed meeting him. And I did see three really interesting films that I'm glad I got a chance to see. I'm going to leave out the first one because it just might come up in our next segment. But the other two films, I finally saw The Band's Visit, the movie that just came out earlier this year, though it was eligible for Oscars and then got into some sort of imbroglio because of the fact that a lot of it's in English and it couldn't be nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. Whatever. The director, Eran Kolaran, was present, and it really is a pretty sweet movie. Very simple. Literally, this band from Egypt goes to Israel to play at the opening of an Arab cultural center, and they go to the wrong town initially, and they sort of just meet the people and hang out with them there in the town. That's the whole plot of the film, but there's some really sweet stuff there, including one of the best single scenes I've seen in a movie in the past year. So maybe that'll come up here on a future show. Also saw Housekeeping. This is a Bill Forsyth film, the Scottish filmmaker, starring Christine Lottie from 1987. And Christine Lottie is just amazing. And I'll admit, just as you're looking at me, Maddie, I'd never even heard of this film until I saw it on the docket for Ebert Fest. But I'm really glad
Christine
I saw it.
Christine Lottie was around in the 1980s.
Yeah, she was. And she was also present at Ebert Fest with Bill Forsyth. They talked with Michael Phillips after the film. And unfortunately, not available on Netflix. I don't know if you can even get it on DVD from TLA Video or anybody else that's out there on Amazon. I don't think it's out there, unfortunately, but really a film that is worth checking out.
Tell me something, would you? Are you fellas really with the Internal Revenue Service?
Your little jokes are meaningless, Mr. Neville.
Or a doctor, or a colonel, whatever it was they called you.
I'm a scientist. What the hell are you?
Definition of a scientist. A man who understood nothing until there was nothing left to understand.
Well, so there is a little light in the forest after all.
Guiding light, Mr. Neville.
Our highly anticipated 70s sci-fi marathon starts with 1971's The Omega Man, and it really is highly anticipated. As I mentioned, we're getting a ton of emails from people who can't wait to play along, so we hope that this marathon lives up to their expectations.
Thank you. I think we guilted them successfully into
so,
playing along with this one.
After Bergman and Almodovar, definitely. Well, this is the second version of Richard Matheson's 1954 sci-fi novel, I Am Legend. Of course, the third version, called I Am Legend, just came out in December, starring Will Smith. Like I Am Legend, Omega Man is set in the post-apocalyptic near future, 1976. But here, instead of a man-made virus, a war between Russia and China breaks out, and the entire population of Los Angeles and maybe the world is wiped out, save for our hero, a scientist, Colonel Robert Neville. Charlton Heston's Neville isn't actually alone, though. In the book and the Will Smith version, he has to contend with bloodthirsty mutants who stalk the city at night. And for you, Maddie, the obviously CGI'd monsters were a distraction. You described them looking like uncooked Johnsonville brats and begged, please just put somebody in makeup. There's no substitute for a living, breathing thing, no matter how bad the makeup job is. Well, ask and you shall receive. Not only do the mutants in the Omega Man live and breathe, they aerobicize. They philosophize. They rage against the human technological machine. Will you cast aside your Luddite ways and recant? Did all the bad makeup, ridiculous costumes, and awful stunt work on display in the Omega Man convert you to the CGI dark side, or just add to the campy fun?
You smug little man.
Uh-huh.
How dare you? How dare you? I love these bad guys so much more than the CGI guys. And the reason is because cults, and that's what these people are, it's a cult, are inherently more scary than brain-dead vampires that scurry around the screen. And this film, now think about it, this film came out just after the Manson family
massacre.
It did. I was
going to note the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And these people are called the family. This film is so much more philosophical in how it deals with the end of the world. It really attempts to tackle this idea of a post-apocalyptic Earth destroyed by man through not only a religious, but a philosophic and also an anthropologic lens. And I love the idea of a cult of survivors emerging and then reverting back to a Luddite firm. Of course, I'm a Luddite myself.
Exactly what
so
I was suggesting.
So I'm going to embrace that. But, all right, and I will give you this. Unfortunately, it's the execution of these bad guys that really, at the end of the day, doesn't make it all that scary. And it's not the makeup so much, but I actually blame the director, and that's Boris Segal. And I'm guessing that's the father of Peg Bundy, Katie Segal. And the action sequences here are really, really bad, especially the ones limited to and around Heston's townhouse. They look really, really stagey. And these are supposed to be night creatures, you know, that are stalking humans, and they come off about as terrifying as sort of an average Murder, She Wrote villain.
Right.
And it's too bad because those action sequences stand out as so cheesy because the rest of the film is really pretty strong for all the reasons I mentioned before.
Well, I love how serious you're being about this film, Maddie, because I think for me, and I did like it, I got into what I would call the campy fun, but the best part of the movie may have been watching it with my wife, and after that scene, the clip we just played where you hear Matthias talking about how bad technology is, she turned to me and said, "So they're like the Amish."
Yes.
They're the mean Amish.
Yeah, they're the mean Amish.
Which I thought was pretty funny, actually. And this movie is pretty insane and all over the place. And I don't want to get off into a discussion of what you initially said about how people are always going to be, and a cult is always going to be more interesting than just a mindless group of zombies or whatever, because I will say that I understand what I Am Legend is going for from more of a metaphorical standpoint. That movie's all about the human frailty and their hubris, right? And so this is the byproduct of that human hubris is creatures like this that are just primal purely.
Yeah, you're right. But this film actually differs a lot from the book. And Richard Matheson has basically disowned the movie in terms of an adaptation of the book. But I will give it a lot of credit for saying, hey, you know what? I mean, and that's what the 70s were all about. Like, the end of the world comes every single year in about three or four blockbusters between 1971 and 1977. Well, these people were really interested in how would mankind react if the world were destroyed. And of course, we're coming off the 1960s, you know, and then the peace, hippie, love, while at the same time we're killing each other in Vietnam. So I'm actually going to give this movie a lot of credit for saying, hey, we're not just going to make them, you know, bloodthirsty animals. We're going to say, no, these are sentient beings who can actually distill between right and wrong, are actually rejecting the future.
Yeah. I give them that credit, too. I give the credit to the director, but also to the screenwriters, John and Joyce Carrington. There is a certain audacity with this film, whether they pull it off or not. It's this kind of everything in the kitchen sink approach, and they do tackle pretty much every hot-button social and political issue from the late 60s or 70s. They're all worked in to this film. And you're right, I do even give them credit for the fact that they said, you know what, are vampires really relevant in 1971? Mm-hmm. They said, let's make this relevant. And so what you get here in this film is Cold War hysterics and paranoia gone crazy. Germ warfare, very prescient in that way. Mainstream culture versus the counterculture, and there is nothing better than watching Mr. NRA himself, Charlton Heston, recite lines from Woodstock, the movie.
I love those scenes.
It's great. And he's
actually
so lonely he keeps watching Woodstock over and
over
again.
You're absolutely right. And a lot of the things that I liked about this film, I liked about I Am Legend. Those first 20 minutes in a deserted Los Angeles where he goes to that abandoned theater and watches Woodstock are riveting. They are terrific.
And I think they're better in I Am Legend.
You do?
I do.
I don't see. I just remember that. I remember the CGI lion coming out and getting
through
the deer, and I thought that was kind of hokey. But what this film has going for it is Charlton Heston. When Charlton Heston is left alone to play pretend that he's the last man on earth.
That's fun for you?
He is really going to play pretend that he's the last man on earth. Now, the fact of the matter is Will Smith in that movie, I Am Legend, we get a lot of scenes that could have been pulled from Independence Day, Men in Black, I, Robot. Will Smith has a charisma, sort of self-deprecatory way about him. And so there's always those sort of scenes that are kind of fun and play on that, but they're all kind of soft and humorous. Charlton Heston, the same kind of scenes. My God, he really believes he is the last man on earth and he is going to fight every step of the way, and I applaud him for it.
Well, I guess I do applaud him as well, though it does just sort of add to the camp factor, I think, in his performance. I Am Legend, as we talked about, solved the problem of having the last man on earth have no one to play off of and talk to by giving him a dog, the Wilson, the volleyball effect. And it worked really well in I Am Legend. Here, what Charlton Heston gets to play off of is a bust of Caesar and
Caesar,
himself.
Your move.
Your move. a picture of himself, his own image on a video screen, on a big TV monitor. And of course, had they given Heston a dog, we would never have gotten my new favorite bit of dialogue in all of cinema. Hey, big brother. How's your ass?
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Only in a movie like this do you get a line like that. When I was talking about all those relevant, topical kind of 70s things, of course, we get the whole racial unrest where when he finally encounters humanity, he meets a black woman who's Rosalind Cash, who's all about black power. And then you're absolutely right. It certainly wasn't lost on me that this movie comes out in 71. The Manson family is on trial in 1970 when they're shooting this film. So this is very much in the air out in L.A., and as we do see, that band of followers of Matthias is called the Family. So clearly a comment there and a rejection of that way of life. And it's interesting that unlike I Am Legend, the mutants here aren't, as I was saying earlier, just this byproduct of the hubris. It's the old versus the new. They're the hippies versus the man. And really, who better embodies the man than Moses himself, Charlton Heston.
No, you're absolutely right. And I will say, unfortunately, those scenes, when they try to attack Heston, A, they don't make much sense, and B, they're just not executed very well.
And the music's wonderful, though, yeah, the 70s
all
music.
Right, fine, fine. All right, you're not going to get into this marathon at all, then fine. I'm not going to be able to help
I am.
You. But once he meets the survivors, the other set of survivors, I actually think that this movie really gained steam, especially after the Dodger Stadium scene. I really liked that scene, and I started to go along with it more.
Yeah, I did too at that point. I agree. I think, of course, I mentioned Moses. You can't think of Heston without some of those old performances. I think maybe he was just determined to play every biblical character at some point in his career, because, of course, here we get the most heavy-handed Christ reference maybe ever in the final shot of this film. And as Michelle, one of our listeners in Tulsa, noted, Neville is betrayed at the end by his female sidekick, by Lisa slash Eve. And we even get a direct reference to the survivors deciding to go out and start a new place, just like in the Garden of Eden. So there's all these heavy-handed biblical references here. I did like the way it was also very skeptical of authority, as you would expect it to be in 1971. And the comment on the media, did you catch that Matthias was the news
newscaster
anchor on TV, of course. So it sort of works that then he ends up being the leader
of this family. That's what I'm saying. It's doing something that I Am Legend didn't do, which I Am Legend was a big budget. Hey, Will Smith is alone in New York. Watch him fight the zombies.
Right.
Here, it actually takes its time to say, we're going to comment on all these things affecting society right now. Whether it goes about it in a kind of clumsy way, I'm going to give it a lot of credit for doing that.
Okay. I give it that credit as well. Even though, you're right, the action scenes are pretty terrible. Some of the dialogue is terrible. At the end, even in a movie like this, I'm sorry, some of the decisions in the story still have to make sense. Character motivations, character actions, they start doing things that absolutely don't make any sense at all.
You're kind of referring
the story
to Richie.
And just where that goes. They're finally saved. They finally have, you know, the Garden of Eden facing them. And instead, she decides she's going to go out shopping, and she doesn't even pay attention to the time. It just sort of doesn't make any sense at all.
You're right.
At the end there. But again, these are maybe quibbles with a film that really is this fun to watch. And I will say, speaking of fun and disturbing, the Charlton Heston Rosalind Cash seduction scene is maybe the most disturbing thing I've ever seen. It's like watching Charlie Rose putting the moves on Alicia Keys or something.
I was the last man on Earth, and you were the last woman on Earth. Oh. Come on. You got to love that.
I mean, so disturbing and awkward. You didn't feel that way?
No.
I was embarrassed.
I was with him.
I'm
like, go for it, Chuck.
You
spread your seed.
The truth of Charlton Heston.
Spread your seed and save this world. We need you.
Unfortunately, Charlton Heston no longer with us, and it was nice to then get a little bit of a tribute here.
Think about it. Who really could play that role? You're not going to put Tom Hanks in that role. You're not going to put Cary Grant in that role. Harrison Ford, yeah. Will Smith, probably. Kurt Russell. But man, anybody. It's either got to be James Cagney or Chucky Heston.
Maybe so. In this particular film, in this type of film, he does work perfectly somehow. So we look forward to discussing The Andromeda Strain next week, another 1971 film based on the Michael Crichton novel. If you have any thoughts on The Omega Man, we know you are. Many of you playing along, send us those thoughts. feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, the top five box office bombs that we like, or as Adam calls it, the Gili Memorial Top Five. Stay with us.
Oh, my love, you make me nervous. No, I won't let you down. You don't deserve this. Oh, your love, it's making circles.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
Coming out on Tuesday, May 6th, a release we are very excited about, one I know I look forward to seeing for the third time, I'm Not There, the Todd Haynes film, the experimental biopic of Bob Dylan. I know we were both big fans of it.
I love that film. Loved how trippy it was.
Deleted scenes on it with optional commentary. There's an audio commentary with director Todd Haynes. Of course, we had him here on the show. If you want to go to our interviews page and check out that interview. There's also a making of I'm Not There feature and audition tapes. You can see Ben Whishaw and Marcus Carl Franklin. Both of their performances, I think, are really good in the film. So check out I'm Not There on Tuesday. Also, two movies I am really curious to check out. One, Don Puree. This is with my boy, Roman Duris, and also Louis Garrel, who is in The Dreamers. I'm not too familiar with the rest of his body of work, but two French actors I like a lot, and it's a kind of romantic comedy, cynical romantic comedy that I've been meaning to check out, and now I finally can. And then Teeth, Maddie. This is the horror movie. Do you want to go ahead and read this brief synopsis I found of Teeth? I know about it because it played at Sundance, but people who don't know what Teeth is all about, here is the description.
Dawn is a pretty but prim high school virgin who unknowingly has a set of mutant teeth between her legs. When a supposedly like-minded boyfriend forces himself upon her, Dawn's vagina dentata start a chompin', which is just the beginning of the most twisted story of female empowerment ever told that's taken from dreadcentral.com. I have to say, this one is actually right now at the top of my queue.
Is
I'm
it?
Really curious about
I added
about
it to
this.
Mine as well. It's actually just right behind Don Puree, though. Also out, if you want to check out a movie that looked absolutely brutal to us, and we are going to get chastised later in the film spotting after hours for being a little too male-centric, P.S. I Love You with Hilary Swank and 300 Gerard
Butler. I tried to get
Gerard
you to go to this thing.
I know.
I tried to get you
and
to go
I
to this
resisted,
thing. Don't drag me down with you.
You want to see it? Is it in your queue?
Number four.
Uh-huh. I believe you too, Maddie. It's out now. You can check those all out this week on DVD, and you can get all the DVDs we mentioned in this segment at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Just click on the Film Spotting movie store link at filmspotting.net. We do want to take a moment now to announce our recasting contest winners. We did Commit Blasphemy, asked you to recast the movie Ghostbusters. A ton of entries. We set a new record in terms of these contests. Really was great to see. Some really tough choices here I know the Spout guys had to make in terms of picking the two winners. We're going to go ahead and announce the first place winner, Frozen Hamster. Frozen Hamster is now the winner of some great American Apparel Spout swag. And I'm just going to set this up, and then, Maddie, you can do the characters here. This is how Frozen Hamster set up his entry. I have for you the David Fincher Mindbender thriller remake of Ghostbusters. It's a film about a crack team of paranormal scientists who uncover the means to hunt down and capture ghosts and go to work to rid a grim New York City of them. It is already being hailed as the most twisted and frighteningly absorbing thriller of the year.
We've got Robert Downey Jr. starring as Dr. Peter Venkman. Brad Pitt, I'm sorry, Adam, starring as Dr. Raymond Stantz. Ed Norton, Dr. Egon Spengler. Forrest Whitaker as Winston Zeddemore. Helena Bonham Carter as Dana Barrett. Kevin Spacey as Lewis Tully. Gwyneth Paltrow as Janine. Wasn't that Annie Potts in
Annie
the original?
Annie Potts, yes.
Wow. Elias Koteas as Walter Peck.
I love Elias Koteas.
I do too. Brian Cox as the mayor. Well done. Jared Leto as the male student. Natalie Portman as the female student. Kate Blanchett as Gozer, of course,
yeah.
Right there. And Meatloaf as Zool, Slimer voice. Unaccredited. Very, very,
very
nicely done.
Inspired there. Congratulations to Frozen Hamster. And Frozen Hamster is really unstoppable. Also offered a British version of the film. I just want to mention this, starring Steve Coogan as Venkman, Simon Pegg as Raymond Stans, Martin Freeman as Egon, Nick Frost as Winston Zeddemore, even though he's white, obviously, Paddy Considine as Lewis Tully, and Bill Nighy as the mayor. Love to see that. The second place winner, though, this one goes to Minor Works. Really inspired stuff here as well. Maddie, why don't you take it away?
You're right. After an executive at Columbia was quoted on certain scenes in Ghostbusters being a tone poem of New York, a succession of directors known for their love of the Big Apple vied for the chance to helm this film. First up, Woody Allen took a shot at a rewrite and submitted his casting ideas to the studio, and here they are. Tony Roberts as Dr. Peter Venkman. What I love here is we turn it into a comeback vehicle for Tony Roberts.
There you
I
go.
Love it. Woody Allen, of course, great pick as Dr. Raymond Stantz. Jeff Daniels as Dr. Egon Spengler. Christopher Walken as Winston Zeddemore. I'm not touching that. Diane Keaton as Dana Barrett. Paul Simon as Lewis Tully.
That's
yes,
a great
inspired.
Pick.
Mia Farrow as Janine. Jeff Goldblum as Walter Peck. Howard Cosell as the mayor. Daniel Stern as the male student. Mariel Hemingway as the female student. Shelley Duvall as Gozer.
Nice.
Well played. Well played, Minor Works. And Woody Allen as Zool, Slimer voice uncredited. Minor Works also offered a Scorsese version, a Spike Lee version, and a straight-to-video version featuring Tom Sizemore and Mark Singer, and I'm guessing we could probably find a role for Tony Roberts in that straight-to-video as well.
I would love to see that one. Great stuff again. Thank you to everyone who entered. It really was a great contest. And congratulations to Frozen Hamster, of course, and to Minor Works, who is going to get a copy of Speed Racer, The Next Generation, The Beginning on DVD. This is picking up on the original series, focusing on Speed Racer's orphan son, and it ties in with, of course, the movie release coming out and also the show airing 7 p.m. Eastern time on Fridays on Nicktoons Network. So we want to, again, congratulate everyone, and your next chance to win a copy of Speed Racer and also that great American Apparel swag. We'll have two winners coming up in 2 weeks. Recast The Breakfast Club. Who's going to take those great roles? Molly Ringwald, Ali Sheedy, Anthony Michael Hall. Can't wait to see what listeners come up with.
They are just stomping all over my childhood.
They are, aren't they?
My God. First it was Ghostbusters, now The Breakfast Club?
Princess Bride. I know, it's terrible. Go to recast.spout.com and make your entries, and we look forward to sharing those here in a couple weeks on the show.
All right, time now to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, we are truly humbled by each and every donation. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much to Diego in Surfside, Florida, Stuart in Melbourne, Australia, Joanne as well in Melbourne, Australia.
We're huge there.
We're huge.
We're rock stars there.
We rock Canberra, too. We also want to thank our Silver Club donors this week. Curtis in Woodbury, Minnesota. Kurt in Albany, California. Barbara in Cupertino, California. And a gold donor this week, thank you so much, to David in London.
Very generous.
Remember that for every $10 you donate, your name is entered in the Film Spotting hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name, and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours.
If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab at the top of the page. Our first listener's choice is coming up next week. We will have our special After Hours edition. This is your last week to get in the running for our next listener's choice review. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and we're looking forward to this top five, a suggestion you had a few weeks ago, Maddie, tying in with summer. Of course, all these big wannabe blockbusters, some of them are going to fail. There are going to be some duds. We thought it might be fun to take a look at some of those duds, not necessarily all summer movies, but some of them certainly, and take a look at them and share the ones that we thought maybe deserved better than they got from audiences and maybe even from critics. So why don't you set up your list, how you went about forming this list, because we really did both spend a lot of time agonizing over how you isolate these films and what really the criteria should be.
Well, this was a lot of fun. Now, you and I, we have to admit, we punched in box office bombs to it. It was Wikipedia.
Yeah, we'll put the link on the site
right
in the notes.
And so we went in and we made rules for ourselves. We said, all right, it's got to be equivalent of at least $50 million. There had to have been some expectations for this film, and it couldn't have made about 50% return. Now, I'm going to hedge it a little bit on
sure,
some picks.
Me too.
But I really wanted to challenge myself, and I really wanted to admit to liking some stinkers, because there were some on the list, like Fantasia, for example, that is really highly regarded critically that
sure,
I didn't want to put on there. I wanted to come out and say, all right, my name is Maddie Robinson, and I like this film.
And take some courage to do it. I agree with you. That's what I wanted to do as well. So my list is very similar in that way, kind of weighing all the numbers and really the reception it got. Are we going to surprise people maybe a little bit with some of these choices? That is what I went for. Did you note how many Brian De Palma films
ooh,
made the list?
There were some Woody Allen on there too.
A few, but Femme Fatale, Bonfire of the Vanities, The Black Dahlia, a lot of his films are in this stinker list. Somehow he gets to keep making films. It's amazing. But
it's a lot of fun. When we post a link, definitely go check it out, because
yeah,
it's a lot of fun to pore over. I do want to give one honorable mention. It's not going to make my top five because I really, really like this film, and actually a lot of critics like this film, and that's 13 Days. And the only reason I mention it is that it was an $80 million budget.
I know.
And this is a living room political drama. Where did they spend $80 million?
Costner's accent teacher?
Oh, geez.
Let's hope not.
You have to think, all right, so was it Costner $20 million?
Maybe.
But still, $60 million for basically what could have been a two-room set.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. It really was overpriced, obviously, over-budgeted there. I don't know. I considered that one as well. I agree with you. I like it.
All right. Well, my number five is Idiocracy. And I just don't know, why didn't the studio give this a full release? They would have at least made some of their money back.
I know why, because it's completely anti-consumerism.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
Wow.
They're bashing all their corporate partners, all the studio's partners, Starbucks,
is that what
it, see, everybody.
I don't know the story behind it at all.
Well, because... I mean, I think that is really it. That was what really turned them off, is that everybody gets killed in this film from a capitalist point of view.
But they're, I mean, come on, they had to sign off on this thing long before it went into production.
Well, and that's why they kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, I think, I love the premise. I think it's great. As a society, we dumb ourselves down to the point where we actually think we need to water our plants with Gatorade.
Uh-huh.
And I love the idea of the anti-hero, somebody who is just as dumb as you or I, going, you know, transported into the future to lead these people.
Yeah.
Critically, it's not as funny as it could be. I mean, there's a lot of flat time in this movie, but there are really some inspired moments, and I wish people do check it out on DVD, which is basically
the only place
people ever could.
Yeah, it came out for about a week in maybe seven cities. It's actually going to come up here in a moment, though. It didn't make my top five. When setting up my list, my top five, if the budget and the gross, none of those numbers we talked about were factors, here's what my top five would be, just in terms of quality of film. Serenity, Grindhouse, Cradle Will Rock, Zodiac, and Almost Famous, and I'd have as an honorable mention The Fountain. Those would be my choices. Just if you look at that Wikipedia list, that really does define a bomb, I think, as a film that basically doesn't recoup its production costs from its domestic.
I'm still waiting on my $12 back from The Fountain from Darren Aronofsky.
Okay, well, I like The Fountain. And so using that definition, I excluded some of these because actually Almost Famous, I mean, it was made for $60 million, and it only made back 54% of it. So that's a bomb. Zodiac, $65 million. Serenity, $40 million. But they all made back at least 50% or more of its budget. So I just decided, okay, they're too successful for this list.
Was Vanilla Sky on the list?
I don't know. I don't remember seeing it.
I don't think it was on there.
I don't think it was
either. But Almost Famous was.
Yeah, Almost Famous was. And then I excluded some movies as well that I considered too artsy, meaning there wasn't enough expectations for them. A movie like A Cradle Will Rock, yes, it was made for $32 million, and I don't want to suggest that that's, you know, a pittance, and it did only make back 8% of that. So it's a huge bomb, but again, did anyone really expect Cradle Will Rock or The Hoax or The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada or The Fountain to make a ton of money? Even Idiocracy only made $1.5 million, cost 30 to make. That's a huge bomb. But again, no one expected it to be a huge success, so that's why I left it off, just as a setup there to my number five, and it is Hulk, the Ang Lee film, which I had a chance to see this past weekend at Ebert Fest, and Ang Lee was in attendance. Now, technically, it's not on the box office bombs list. It doesn't meet the requirement, but I don't think anyone's going to argue with me that it's widely considered to be a bomb, and the reason why is it made $62 million its opening weekend, the 16th highest opener ever at the time.
Wait for it.
The word of mouth was so bad that it dropped the second weekend 70%, which no film above $20 million ever dropped over 65% before. So it was a huge failure, and its final North American gross was only $132 million, and it cost $120. So really a bomb. And it made me realize, watching it again at Ebert Fest, at that great screen at the Virginia Theater, and I definitely recommend, if you ever have a chance to go to Ebert Fest, you should definitely check it out. You have to be careful when you casually dismiss movies, maybe like you did a few weeks ago with Heat, like I've done, I'm sure, at least one point or two on this show with the movie Hulk, because it turns out I had never actually seen the whole film from start to finish, and I certainly had never seen it on the big screen. I had just seen it on HBO on my TV at home. It turns out that even though, of course, it is a very flawed film, I'll say, it's also a pretty interesting, intense, psychological horror movie, even more than an action movie or a comic book movie. It's a pretty scary, angry film, and I can understand why then it didn't make any money at the box office. Ang Lee talked about after the film how he didn't want this to be his last film. He was so burned by this movie and put so much effort into it that he almost considered not making any more movies, but didn't want such an angry film to be the last thing he had made. And seeing it on the big screen, where you get to see everything Ang Lee was trying to do visually with the movie in terms of the split screens and all the angles and the effects, it really did pay off for me. I liked The Hulk the second time around. I recommend giving it another chance.
Sam Elliott and Eric Bana burning up the screen.
Burning up the screen. Eric Bana, or as I like to call him now, Eric Blanda. And Sam Elliott, my boy, I think he's great in that film.
All right, well, my number four, Adam, you know me. I love old epic movies. D.W. Griffiths, I think, was the grandfather of epic movies. Michael Curtiz was a great disciple, and I think Cecil B. DeMille probably perfected the art form. So it's fitting I put the movie that basically killed the genre because it was such a bomb. I'm going with the great Liz Taylor and Richard Burton in Cleopatra.
Wow.
I mean, it's bloated. It is. And the dialogue is really hard to listen
Liz
to.
Liz Taylor or the film?
Which
one?
Ooh,
sorry.
Ouch.
Sorry.
My friend.
Had to.
Ouch. You are a cruel, cruel man.
I was not
going to go there. It's hard to listen to because a great deal of the dialogue is improvised by the actors on the set. But it is beautiful to look at, and I actually really appreciate a lot of the supporting performances of this film, especially Roddy McDowall and Martin Landau as well. Its cost of $44 million is equivalent to $270 million in today's dollars.
Unbelievable. A great pick there. My number four is a film that cost $50 million, only made back 7% of that. So less than $5 million, if my math is correct. And it's the Mark Forster film Stay from a few years ago. Forster, of course, is the guy who did The Kite Runner and Stranger Than Fiction and Monster's Ball. It's got Ewan McGregor in it and Ryan Gosling and Naomi Watts. So it's got a great cast. It's a really difficult film to watch, terribly awkward, and something just always seems off about just about every aspect of the film. So much so that I'd like to share these comments from a certain former Film Spotting co-host who emailed me one night. Tried to watch Stay last night. How did you get through it? It's terrible. Maybe the worst dialogue I've ever heard. Laugh out loud, funny. And he's right if you don't stick with the film and wait until the end and get the payoff of the movie where you do see that the awkwardness and the bad dialogue is there actually for a reason. It doesn't pay off so well that it makes the film great by any means, but enough that it made it worth sitting through, and I do actually look forward to seeing Stay again.
I have never, ever heard of that
really?
Thing.
Really? Okay. $50 million.
Did it get any advertising at all?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, my number three was pretty heavily advertised. He Who Controls the Spice Controls the Universe. Again, I'm going with another bloated costume drama, only this one is a futuristic soap opera directed by David Lynch.
Nice.
Dune. There's just something devilishly fun about this film. Of course, the quotable dialogue. Of course, I throw all these quotes at you and you never get them.
No, like, that's true.
I am the Shattered Mapes, the housekeeper. I love it. The giant worms, the Toto soundtrack.
Dune, for me, a film I never, again, like Hulk, seen from start to finish all the way through.
Yeah, and reportedly Lynch won't even discuss
right.
this film. But for my money, I mean, come on, you put it on. It's watchable.
Okay.
I'm going to watch, probably not all the way through, and that's actually a comment that's going to come up again. But still, there are moments there I'm like, yeah.
Of course.
Way to
Sting.
Go, Kyle MacLachlan.
There you go.
Nice.
Kyle MacLachlan, the future Agent Dale Cooper, one of my all-time favorite characters, certainly in television. So Dune, a good choice there. And my number three, I'm going with Miami Vice, the Michael Mann film. $135 million budget, made back less than 20% of that.
$130 million for a Steadicam.
Yeah, exactly. For a handheld, whatever it's doing, there are story problems, and the fact is Farrell and Jamie Foxx, Colin Farrell, of course, they're probably phoning it in for most of the film. It does seem like that, but I like it actually for exactly the same reason I'm guessing it didn't connect with a lot of people, is that Mann completely lost all the flashiness of the TV series, and he didn't pay any ironic nods to the TV series either. The whole movie is about isolation and emptiness, and there's nothing cool about the lives we see on screen. The photography's all grainy, the characters are all flawed, and I think somehow Michael Mann made an intimate $135 million international drug-running movie. I don't know how he did it. Again, not a great film, but not as bad as most people seem to think.
Well, I tell you what, I actually did like Miami Vice a little bit, and I liked it more than a documentary that came out around the same time called Cocaine Cowboys. I actually liked the grittiness of what Miami Vice was going for than sort of the glamorous lifestyle Cocaine Cowboys mm-hmm. trots out there.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it.
I did like Miami Vice.
Okay.
I gotta say that.
Good.
Wow.
All right. Well, number two, maybe we'll agree on some more here.
Okay. Well, I do like post-apocalyptic movies.
Yes.
I admit that. I liked Omega Man.
Oh, man.
I'm going with the Guild one. Kevin Costner.
There it is. The Postman?
In Waterworld.
Oh, Waterworld.
Oh, man. Look, I think the action sequences in this film are top-notch. And the fact of the matter is, the film recouped about 50 to 60% of what it cost. And it cost about $132 million. It's not the kind of movie, like I said, that I'm going to watch in one setting. But I have to admit, when it's on TV, I'm going to linger on some of those scenes because I think the battle scenes are really, really nicely done.
Okay. Well, I can't really argue with you. Again, with Waterworld, one of those films, I don't know that I've ever given it a full viewing. And maybe it doesn't deserve a full viewing, but at some point, maybe I'll have to break down. Well, my number two, I'm going with another Colin Farrell movie here. And you could actually throw in The New World, which only made like $12 million, the, of course, Terrence Malick movie. But Heart's War.
Good film.
Thank
you. Good film.
Well, it's hard to believe that it had a $70 million budget, but it was a Bruce Willis vehicle, and it was Colin Farrell's first big movie after Tigerland. He gets kind of top billing there along with Bruce Willis. It's a World War II prisoner of war movie. Terrence Howard's in it. He and another black soldier come into this war camp, and Terrence Howard gets accused of killing another soldier, played by Cole Hauser, who's a young actor I like a lot. The Nazi commandant agrees to have a trial with Farrell's character, defending him. He was a former law student. It's directed by Gregory Hoblit, who I just thought did a brutal job with the movie Fracture. But it was written by, and I had to look this up to find out, now I'm not surprised, it was written by Billy Ray, who was the writer-director of Shattered Glass and Breach. So here he gives us two really interesting flawed heroes, which I enjoyed about the movie. I do think that's probably, again, why it didn't have much success. I don't think people like watching Bruce Willis be not really heroic and not a good guy in many ways. So I think that's maybe why it failed, but it's a movie I actually do like.
Yeah, it's not a great film. There are some ridiculous aspects to it, but yes. Bruce Willis, another name that kept coming up on that list.
That's true.
Bonfire of the Vanities.
Hudson Hawk.
Hudson Hawk, name after name.
That's true.
All right, well, my number one, Adam, my dad has always said, go big or go home. And I think it's fitting that we're reviewing Iron Man this week because my number one is also another Marvel superhero. I'm going with Howard the Duck.
You didn't.
I am.
Wow.
I am. I know that there was no way that this film was ever going to live up to its hype. It is universally panned, but think about it. It's not boring. I mean, if you're going to go big and fail, you might as well go big and crazy and fail. It's about a duck that is transported through the universe to our time, and it's basically a guy in a duck suit. And he's going to save the universe with Leah Thompson in her nightgown.
I remember.
Against Jeffrey Jones. Look, I remember loving it as a kid. I don't know if it holds up. I can't tell because it's not available on DVD. I don't know why. But, hey, I've got a soft spot for it. And at least it tried something. At least it really tried something and failed miserably. And I'm always going to give you credit for that.
Okay. Well, let's get to my number one then. A very bold choice by you, Maddie. This choice definitely not as bold, but it is a film I do really like. Let's hear a scene from it.
Am I alive or dead?
We don't have to think like that anymore. We're together now. Everything we've done is forgiven. Everything.
Well, that's a scene from a film that cost $47 million, so just shy of our $50 million floor there. Only made back 32% of it. That is Solaris, the Steven Soderbergh film with George Clooney. And the big thing to remember here, before you go, wait a second, really, were there a lot of expectations for that movie? Yes, there were. I remember when it came out. This was the first Soderbergh movie and George Clooney movie after Ocean's 11. That's why they gave it that budget.
I always looked at it as like a pet project.
They
but you're
really,
right. The budget
they
surprised
tried to sell
me.
It. Yeah.
The budget surprised
me. The budget
me.
Was high, and Soderbergh at the time was really nervous about the fact that he knew the studio was trying to really sell it. There was a pretty big marketing blitz for this movie, and he knew it wasn't really going to be that kind of a blockbuster. But that was the way the studio was trying to sell it. It's not the masterpiece that Tarkovsky's original is, but I think it's still a really effective sci-fi movie. I think Soderbergh deals with a lot of the same fundamental human questions that Tarkovsky does, and I think it's a really haunting love story. Natasha McElhone and, of course, Clooney in that film. I really like Solaris. I think there are a lot of people out there, in my experience, who don't think it's a very good film, one of Soderbergh's misses. I think it's right up there with some of his better films, so it's my number one.
You know, Soderbergh keeps coming out with these sort of small projects,
yes.
And I always respect him for that, so I'm not going to lambaste him for that, so I would never consider it a flop to begin with.
Okay.
I don't love the film, but I'll admit, you're really surprising me. I didn't realize it was only, I didn't realize it was an over $40 million
yeah,
budget.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Well, a couple of quick honorable mentions. Lolita. This is the Adrian Lyne version of Lolita. $50 million budget. You know how much it made back of that? 2% of that, like $1.5 million.
As, what, the Jeremy Irons
Jeremy
one?
Irons, who's an actor I love, is in that film. Dominique Swain, absolute bomb. And also, Flash Gordon cost $35 million in 1980, a Mike Hodges film, only made $4 million. And I did find some calculator online and did the math. $35 million today from 1980 is, at a minimum, $66 million. That's how much Flash Gordon cost.
I think there were so many films on this list that I haven't seen. At some point, way down the road, we need to do a film spotting marathon of box office bombs.
Great idea.
Heaven's Gate,
yep.
Ishtar.
Baby, there you go.
Ishtar. All right. Well, those are our top five box office bombs that we like. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. Please be as brave as possible on
there
your list.
There you go. Opening wide this weekend. I made a mistake last week saying that Maid of Honor, the Patrick Dempsey film, and Iron Man were coming out. Of course, getting the releases mixed up with our next show. Those films are opening this weekend, though, of course, and The Visitor, which we reviewed on last week's show, is expanding to more screens in limited release. On next week's show, we're going to review Errol Morris's new documentary, Standard Operating Procedure. I know it just screams summer, doesn't it? And we will fit in some thoughts, but probably not a full review on Speed Racer. Go Speed Racer, Maddie can't wait.
Yeah, you got to cut us some slack on this one. You and I are huge Errol Morris fans. And the fact of the matter is, I'm not looking forward to this Speed Racer thing at all. The only thing I know about Speed Racer are those Matthew Sweet music videos from the 1990s. I don't know anything about this. I know the Wachowski brothers?
Wachowski brothers, whatever. Yeah,
yeah,
the Matrix guys.
Yeah, the Matrix guys. Well, the Matrix 1 guys, and then they took my money for 2 and 3.
Yes, they did.
All right. Well, thanks as always to our wonderful listener volunteers, Candace, Frank, and Angela. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio. And to Fever Marlene for this week's music. Learn more at fevermarlene.com. And also, don't forget to check out all the great Film Spotting swag available at filmspottingswag.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net. You should really go into a career as a jingle writer.
Dude, I have this song written I think is really good.
Oh, yeah?
One of these days I'll bring it in. Because I was actually, the girl that I went on the day with, I was like, because she plays piano. I was like, I've actually got some songs that I think we could team up and write them.
And you said that to her?
She was totally into it. Well, dude.
No wonder she went to see her grandmother.
I'm telling you.
Why don't you just bring her home to see Sharon Robinson?
Sharon Robinson is a saint.
I know she is. I'm a big fan of Mrs. Robinson.
What is it? What's that line? Dorothy Mantooth is a saint. That's from Anchorman.
Uh-huh.
Vince Vaughn. That's one of my favorite forgotten lines. Dorothy Mantooth is a saint.